Let's take you behind the scenes in the horrible Nazi bureaucracy. Katrine Paler is an ISU history professor who has published a book on the Third Reich's intelligence service, in particular, the career of a man named Walter Schellenberg, the head of the Foreign Intelligence Service, or Department 6. Paler says she was interested in Nazi intellectuals, a whole group of young men who entered the SS, Himmler's secret police, and entered the security service. Paler says she was interested in them because they were different from the run-of-the-mill Nazis who entered the party early and rose through the ranks.
Different about them is their education. So we're talking about university-educated people here to quite some extent. That is very different from many other high Nazi officials. So that makes them unusual. What also makes them unusual is the way they sell their commitment, the way they talk about their commitment or don't talk about their commitment to Nazi Germany. So the way how they portray themselves at the time and then after the war as well. So that's where I would locate the main difference.
Are they common as a class about the shifting ground? It's initially portraying themselves as true believers and then fighting their bureaucratic battles, and then after the war saying, oh, it was something else. I just had to do it because that was how you had to act in my country.
Let's just say they're common enough. They're common enough, but they also, these are not the men that after the war define the image of Nazi Germany. What defines the image is the brown shirt, the SA person. What defines the image is the, to some extent, crazy, or what seems to be very crazy from the outside. So it's not these particular men who define the image. And that was to some extent what drew me to that, this particular group of people which assembles, gathers in the SD, and becomes quite important there.
So talk about Schellenberg. He started out as a medical student and then switched to law and joined the Nazi Party in 1933 and very quickly became a rising star. What made him that rising star and similar to this class of young intellectuals that you're looking at?
Well, he claimed to be a medical student. Actually, I haven't found that in the records. So what I can tell from the records is that he was always a student of law.
Why claim that?
Because it made for a good story after the war. That so Schellenberg survives the war. He is put on trial in the subsequent trials at Nuremberg, gets a few years in prison, gets out early, writes an autobiography, which is an autobiography very much written for the West German post-war public and for the Anglophone public. So here he is telling a story of a young man who had this humanist leaning of sorts, wanted to be a medical student, but decided to study law because it was the more prudent decision, financially more prudent decision. And I just find it interesting. It's a throwaway line in his autobiography, and it shows up in lots and lots of books on where he is mentioned. It's a small thing, but I went into his records, student records, and there's no indication that he ever studied medicine.
Small details matter in crafting a legend. What other kinds of things popped out at you when you took a detailed look at his life that were false or served to shape his narrative?
The way how he talks about his family or doesn't talk about his family or what he then decides to share about the family. So he very much crafts his narrative before 1933 of that, of a young man who is comes from a family that was battered very hard by the end of World War I and the reparations. So he's feeding into this whole myth.
But you're making the point that he paid his tuition on time and he was pretty stable in his finances.
Yes, he was. I mean, I can't tell where his money is coming from, but he's always paying his tuition on time. So you can see from the matriculation box where he signs up and they basically put in a check mark if you pay. And he pays in full each and every time. And there's also this really intriguing decision for him to go to this particular university where he's going at that point in time. So that is the first career move he's making.
It's a quality university in Marburg.
It's a quality university. It's also a university which is at that point known for radical right-wing politics among the students.
So he's already tacking.
Yes, he's not involved with the Nazis at that point, but he also gets himself involved with a very prestigious fraternity. So, you can see the social climber there, the social political climber very early on, and I find it quite fascinating. And not that religion is the most important point. For all I know, he never was particularly religious, but he came from a Catholic background. Marburg is the oldest Protestant university in all of Germany. Very proudly so. It doesn't mean that you can't be Catholic to go to that university, but there is a statement in there for a person of that background from that part of the country going to this university at that point in time.
It's a cultural statement.
It's also a political statement, mm-hmm. I would argue.
Okay.
More so than a cultural statement.
So is he common? Is he a type of striver here who fashions themselves and creates almost a con?
I wouldn't quite call it a con, but I would argue that he's very much part and parcel of this group of youngish men who try very hard to make their way.
So in a lot of bureaucratic apparatuses, and the intelligence services of Nazi Germany are a bureaucratic apparatus full of infighting, as you make clear here, full of navel gazing, in addition to looking outside, according to their mission statements. In a lot of cultures like that, you're not going to get such a concentration of strivers, of myth makers about themselves. You're going to get some people like that, but you're going to also have careerists. You're also going to have people who believe in mission. You're looking at this class and saying, these rose to the top almost uniformly. What about Nazi Germany made these folks' ascension more prevalent than in other places, perhaps?
Nazism was to quite some extent a youth movement. So it was a really good place for young and ambitious men to make careers well fast. Everybody was young. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is a very important point we tend to lose sight of. How ridiculously young everyone was. And it was also a world in which the world was created anew. So radical ideas could find more than a hearing, could find support. The eminent British historian Ian Kershaw talks about working towards a Führer. So working towards a leader, anticipating what the leader wants. If you're good at that, you can make a career in Nazi Germany. And if you are able to navigate this difficult, somewhat difficult in-between time, the move from a bureaucracy that originated in the Weimar Republic into the new bureaucracy, if you can navigate that and talk about that smartly and are both ideological and pragmatic, you're basically golden.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with ISU history professor Katrine Paler about her book, The Third Reich's Intelligence Services, The Career of Walter Schellenberg. One of the ways in which he worked toward the Führer was to hitch himself to Himmler. How did that work?
Schellenberg is really good at finding patrons all through his career. So he makes this very rapid rise, even for Nazi standards, through the SD by basically finding himself always a patron who is one or two steps ahead of himself and proving himself to that person. And the most important here before Himmler, and I'll get to him in a moment, is actually Heydrich, Reinhard Heydrich. And Heydrich finds himself in a bit of a predicament in 37, 38, 39. And it's trying to figure out how this new bureaucracy of Nazi Germany is going to look. So the question becomes, are the new bureaucrats of the state to be, are they going to be political soldiers, meaning ideologues, or are they going to be, let's put it like this, traditionally trained bureaucrats? And it has to do obviously with the bureaucracy, but for the men who are in the middle of this, it also has to do with state positions, state pensions, what qualifications does one need to do what. So Schellenberg, to some extent, to quite some extent, is the political soldier, the ideologue. But Schellenberg, having studied law, he can also make the law argument. So he is the man in between who decides to throw in his lot very early on with Heydrich, because he seems to be very good at reading the environment, reading the room, and Heydrich is the coming man.
Apart from that, you also have your external mission. It's a foreign intelligence service that he's starting to head. Did he deliver?
No. Next question.
Okay.
It was an epic failure as an intelligence service. What makes this particular intelligence service so interesting is that it's a completely new outfit within the SD. It's sometimes called Amt Ausland, sometimes Office 6, depending on what year you are in. And they envision this as a political foreign intelligence service. And political here very much means that everybody comes out of the Nazi worldview. There was no shortage of intelligence services in Germany. So there's a traditional Abwehr, the military intelligence service, and much of what Office 6, Amt 6 wanted to do was to collect political intelligence, and that to quite some extent was done by the diplomatic services. So it was a crowded field, to say the least. The claim to fame was that they are more ideological, that they are more Nazified, that they know how to do it right. They knew how to interpret the world in the proper sense.
Is this a cautionary tale about allowing ideology to shape your product and make it ineffective?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the epitome of a cautionary tale when it comes to while screwing up intelligence collection.
Give a couple examples, would you?
Say, for example, they're looking at Hungary. And every problem they see with a German ally of Hungary is focused on the Jewish influence in Hungary that still exists, according to the SD, in 1940. So they are also then making policy prescriptions in a way that might please Himmler, Hitler. And the same, you see it mostly in the reporting, the same way they look at the United States. And at a certain point, there's a list going around of people in the United States and politicians who might support Nazi Germany. And basically, it is a wish list. A wish list also in the sense that everybody who isn't for Roosevelt is going to be for Hitler.
It does not follow.
Yes, it does not follow, but there's very much this ideological thinking here.
He tended his myth even after he got out of prison, and he got a very light prison sentence, as you make the point. How did he do that?
He got this very light prison sentence because he managed to portray himself as a humanist and what I call a thwarted bringer of peace. Because in the last month of the war, Schellenberg was actually engaged in, I'm trying to find the words carefully here, engaged in peace soundings with Western allies.
Is that legitimate, or is that him reading the political winds and deciding, I'm going to become a refugee and position myself here?
I think it's all of the above.
Katrine Paler is the author of The Third Reich's Intelligence Services, The Career of Walter Schellenberg, out from Cambridge University Press. She's a professor of history at Illinois State University.